If you've been told to pull up your socks, then make sure it's a pair of TNT socks. The TNT shop is now open at tntradio.live.
Limbit Opic.
This is the Limbit Opic Show on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Thank you very much to my previous guest and welcome back to the Limbit Opic Show here on today's News Talk. We have another fantastic and fascinating guest, John Padbury, in this section of the show. Before we go to him, let me respond, or at least share some of the responses from yourselves in terms of what we've just been listening to, and the Natural Women's Council in Ireland, which is really trying to re-establish some sense of perspective, some might say common sense, into Irish politics. They were one of the groups that were instrumental in ensuring that the Constitution of Ireland wasn't changed to junk the words women and mothers. Apparently, these words are now controversial in the eyes of some authority individuals in Ireland. They didn't seem too controversial to me when I was growing up. And she also pointed out the sexualization of children and created some very worrying observations about, for example, the fact that there could be a secrecy pact between teachers and young children at school, where they're told not to share what they're learning at school about sex and gender with their parents. Well, this is tremendously disturbing, and we will return to this on my show here at today's News Talk TNT in the future. Some comments from you. Morton says, when I was a swimming teacher, that was one of the signs we were told to look out for. Children will often come out with info to someone who is not their parent. For example, the phrase, our little secret. Well, Morton, if now the teachers are saying to the children, let's make this our little secret, it definitely muddies the waters very, very much. I'm concerned about more. Annie says, subscribe to Natural Women's Council on YouTube. I'm concerned that you should do that. I think you'll learn, whether you agree with them or not, you'll learn something much deeper than we could cover in just an hour there with Jana. Holly says, people know things aren't right, but refuse to take their heads out of the sand. It really will take a massive disaster or breakdown to get these stubborn idiots to fight for their freedoms. Let's hope it won't be too late. We must not comply. Thanks for that, Holly. Hemingway adds, that guest was an absolute gem, Limbit. Congratulations. Well, thank Charlotte. Charlotte, my producer, was able to negotiate Jana London's contribution to the show. So thank you, Charlotte, from Hemingway. I can't take the credit for that. Chris agrees with Holly. The people know that things aren't right, but don't quite know what to do. Holly agrees it's shocking for sure. And Hermetica likes Jana London's phrase, make those big talks small talk. Excellent advice. That's a really good phrase. I suspect that's pretty much how the Taliban got control of Afghanistan. They did little things in villages. They won hearts and minds and found themselves in an unassailable position. Whether you like the Taliban or not, they made big talk through small talk. Just a Bloke says, truly wonderful guest, then, but totally agree. Here's a thought. Chris says, cooling heads to warmer climes further south. Bring all those citizens up north to free up the land. That is a reference to my ongoing complaint about the environmental rubbish claptrap, which I won't have time to cover in this hour. I'll try and do it at the beginning of the next hour, but you've been so conversational about what we've just seen. I think it's more important I share your views than mine, which is why I'm doing this. Hope you agree that's the right thought. Holly's talking about getting people to take their blinkers off and so on, and a very clear and candid commentary there. Thanks for that, Holly. Chris says, same with my family. Can't get them away from the mainstream media propaganda. Increasingly, I tend to agree with you there, Chris. I do tend to watch the mainstream media, MSM, before I come here, because I want to see what they're saying. And I triangulate what they're saying, perhaps in the hope that they might say something which I hadn't thought about before, but also with the expectation of having my own thinking tested. So there is a benefit to watching it, but not necessarily with the view to being indoctrinated. I think you need to hear all views, including wrong ones, in order to get the best view that you can have. Lord Melbury says child trafficking is endemic within the major charities, been that way for decades. They hide behind the squeaky clean, benevolent image they create for themselves. But there's a very dark underbelly that people are just beginning to discover. You didn't mention anything specifically there, and had you done so, I probably wouldn't have been able to read it out without checking it. But there is a deep concern I share with the sexualization of education of children. I think that nature has got that more or less sorted at a period in your teens, when you reach puberty, in most cases at that age, that things begin to work themselves out. Lots more comments there. Do please keep your calls and comments coming. As I say, I always prefer to share your views and mine. I will come back to the environmental debate a little bit later on. You can also follow me, incidentally, at my X or Twitter, at Lembitopic. You'll see me standing in front of the old Greater London Assembly building next to the Thames there. That's my official. I've only got one official handle. There seems to be, is it called a handle? I'm at 59, I'm not sure I'm using the right phrase. But do follow me on Twitter, on X. And thanks to Charlotte, I've got a lot more active on that recently as well. So the dialogue continues throughout the week there, as well as at the weekend. But coming up next, let's talk about revolution. Let's talk about things that might unsettle the establishment with John Padbury. He has got decades of experience in law enforcement and beyond. He joins me in just a moment right here on the Lembitopic Show on TNT.
Bringing you a world view.
I like to hear what's going on around the world.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
John Padbury, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us. Where in the world are you physically?
I'm in North Devon, Biddeford area.
It used to be a Liberal Democrat area. It sort of comes and goes since Nick Clegg's absolutely catastrophic mismanagement of the country. That area went quite blue as far as I recall. But you're not here to let me bellyache about my disappointment with Nick Clegg, but not least because you have a fascinating pedigree that goes right back to 1969 in South Africa. Tell us a bit about your journey.
Well, ironically, I was born in Bangor, Northern Ireland.
Like me.
Common ground. Yeah. My mom was living in then Rhodesia, which is now Zimbabwe. She came over to the UK, to Bangor, to see her folks. Her dad wasn't very well, and she was pregnant with me. So I was born in Bangor, and when I was 9 weeks old, returned to Rhodesia, Zimbabwe, where I was raised. I wanted to thank you, before we went on, I just wanted to thank you for the opportunity to come onto your platform and talk about my book. And also thank you for the work you're doing for one of our colleagues, Clive Freeman, who you've supported on your network as well. Thank you very much for that.
It's symbiotic, and it's a pleasure. Two things. In terms of the serious point you've made there, it's increasingly clear to me that today's News Talk, TNT, is performing a vital function, which has been not just abandoned, but oppressed by the mainstream media, which seems to be in desperately depressing and sometimes coercive collusion with the establishment. And I suspect that's one reason we've ended up helping Clive. I myself am a libertarian, as I often say, and I find your candidness about, I'm going to talk about your book in the book and so forth, quite refreshing. But just the other point, it's possible that you and I were born within, not the same time, but within 50 feet of each other in the same hospital, Bangor Hospital. That's where I was born, 1965. A small world, yes. You'll remember.
A little bit before you, I was 51, 1951. Well,
same hospital, 14. Yeah. They actually shut down. They actually closed down that hospital sometime after we were both born. But it's quite likely we were, our mums were in the same ward, for all we know. Yeah. Just one dimension apart and three dimensions the same. I still go to Bangor. And Bangor's been gentrified since our days, by the way. It was a fairly humble fishing port at the time. Now it's where the wealthy live because it's a 25-minute train journey to Belfast. Do go back out of interest.
Yes, I got family there. My aunt recently passed, which was sad, but I've still got my cousins over there. We go over once every, say, 2 years, we go back.
I do feel, I nearly worked at what's now called Belfast City Airport, but when it was still Short Brothers, I was offered a sponsorship there to do our engineering, but events took a different turn. But when I go back, it still feels like home to me. You also, though, lived in South Africa, where you eventually, well, in 1969, you got involved in the police services.
Well, it was Rhodesia is where we lived. 1969 is when I joined the British South Africa Police.
Yeah, right.
Essentially, as a policeman in those days, I joined to be a policeman. But events took over in the revolution, which is the Rhodesian Civil War, or the what was known as the Second Chimurenga started. So I joined the CID actually initially, but then was transferred to a little town called Resapi, which is on the eastern districts of the country. And that's where I started getting involved in the insurgency issues.
And so you saw a very interesting part of the world at a very interesting time. What did you learn from your experiences there? Because you went on to have some very significant roles in other enforcement agencies, some of which sound quite James Bond-like, to be honest.
What did I learn? I learned the strategies and tactics of the insurgents. There were two groups of insurgents. There was ZANLA, which is Zimbabwe African National Liberation Army, that was headed up eventually by Robert Mugabe. And then I was there for 4 years in that operational field. And then I moved across to the other side of the country, where I was involved with Zipra insurgents. That's Joshua Nkomo's military wing. So I learned the strategies and tactics of the both groups of insurgents, which in some ways are similar, but they had their differences. And I learned the strategies and tactics, obviously, of the security forces and our special branch intelligence operations, as well as the insurgents' intelligence operations. A lot of our time initially, because we were thrown into that war, we didn't really know much about it. So we had to learn what their intelligence operations, how they operated. And once we broke that, it was a little easier to operate against them.
And you took that experience into the special branch, where you were involved in a different kind of conflict, didn't you?
Yes. The first 4 years, I was involved in traditional counterinsurgency operations. That would be if you looked at counterterrorism in an operational field globally, if you look at Vietnam, Afghanistan, and so on, they would all be similar type of operations, where the focus is actually on killing the enemy, as opposed to understanding what I call the GNA, the grievances, needs, and aspirations of the people. In other words, the will of the people. So in the first field of operation, really our strategy, what I call a political strategic aim, was to eliminate the insurgents. That was what we were there to do. When I moved from the that first operational area, I realized that actually we were losing the war quite rapidly. We'd lost the people. We didn't take into consideration the will of the people. There was a lot of discontent. There was racial disharmony, even among, unfortunately, with the forces. When I say that, I mean discrimination with pay and rank and conditions of service. We treated them equally as in the field. We got on well together. But there was that discrimination. And I looked at that and I thought, well, we're losing this war. In fact, I resigned from the police. And as I resigned, my senior officers asked me if I wanted to continue, because I didn't want to leave the country, but I just knew we were losing. So my wife wasn't very happy with it, but I decided to carry on. And that's when I moved across to the other operational area against the the Zipper insurgents. And it's there where I learned a lot more about the understanding revolution and the counter-revolution, that essentially it's the people who win wars, not the majority or the stronger force, and understanding the GNA, the grievance needs and aspirations of the people, and addressing them and politically getting their consent enables you to, what we actually did was to recruit, train, arm, and permanently deploy the locals from that Urungwe tribal trust land, and we deployed them back into the field to defend their own people, because they were being quite brutally handled by the Zipper insurgents. The strategy of the pattern of revolution, there's four patterns to it. There's infiltration, propagation, isolation, and then operation.
I want you to explain that in more detail just after the break, because we're getting actually into your book now. And if it's okay with you, John, I really want to get into the book, because I find this fascinating. I grew up in Northern Ireland all the way through to the age of 20. And much of what you're saying reminds me of things I learned as Shadow Secretary of State for Northern Ireland. So hold that thought. I want to come back to your book as well. We'll talk more about that. We're talking with John Badbury. He's one of the most informed people when it comes to revolution and counter-revolution that I've spoken to right here in today's news talk. We'll go back to him in just a minute. See you after the break.
TNT's Mark Morano.
This is a story that has no really boundaries, because you can't look at this and say, oh, well, Biden's under law is prescribed these powers. Once you declare an emergency, they do whatever they want. It takes the federal court system in the United States years to stop them. I've used the example before, the CDC telling landlords they can't evict renters, the Centers for Disease Control, CDC, forcing mask mandates on planes, trains, automobiles, completely unconstitutional, unauthorized, beyond their purview. It was eventually stopped, but nearly 2 years after it started, wreaking havoc on travel across the United States.
Mark Morano on today's News Talk, TNT. At the top of the hour, we'll keep on top of the news.
It's the most important thing we can do.
On today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back to the Lembotobic Show. Just on a technical point, I'll remind you later, I've been getting questions because I've got active on Twitter or X or whatever they want to call themselves. My official Twitter or X site is @Lembotobic. No, none of the other ones are me. It's just that one. So it's got about 9,700 followers, and there's a picture of me looking very formal. I might change that picture sometime soon. So that's where you'll find me. But I'll remind you about that later. I want to get back to our fascinating guest, John Padbury, who I was having an interesting conversation with while we were in the break there. John, you have a book. Let's get to your book now. What's it called to begin with?
Battle for Urungwe, a special branch victory in an unwinnable war.
And there's a clue in the name, but tell us a little bit about what that battle was and why was it an unwinnable war?
Well, if you consider the population of what was then Rhodesia, it was 4% European and 96% African. So that's not really very good odds for a fight. And also at that point in time, which was the 60s, African nationalism was sweeping through Africa. And the countries wanted their wanted their countries back. They were pressing for majority rule, so there was conflict growing throughout Africa, actually, and that spilled over to insurgency, which either was Russian backed or Chinese backed.
So it was 24-1 against in terms of the numbers, and what was your What was your duty? What were you being told to achieve?
Well, I think initially I was very junior in those days, in the early days, but I think initially we completely underestimated what the insurgents were about. Our job was to find and eliminate them, basically, to gather, in my particular role, was to gather intelligence and feed it to the security forces and the various branches of the security forces, work out the best strategy to attack, and then they would carry out the attack on the insurgents. But essentially, it was to find their location, pinpoint them.
Was it dangerous work?
I think it was. Well, we didn't, being young, we didn't think it was at the time, but bear in mind that we were working in what was known as African tribal trust lands. That's where the Africans were resident. They're very rural, dirt roads. There were a lot of landmines on the roads and periodical ambushes by the insurgents. So, yeah, it was dangerous.
I was involved in the Estonian independence movement around 89 to 92, and it was really dangerous, but I didn't know that because I was 26. When you're 26, you're indestructible and you don't think the KGB are really interested in you, but they were. And that's why I got followed. That's the advantage of youth. Perhaps we achieve some of our most courageous contributions to the world without even realizing it.
Totally oblivious to it.
Yeah, and I think it's necessary. I've been told more than once that people who race motorcycles must lack imagination because the accidents can be horrendous. How did it end up? And what are the lessons? What are the messages that you portray in your book, aside from, of course, it being a pretty interesting story from a historical perspective?
Well, I think I am not really in favor of war. I'm opposed to war. I think there are a lot of hidden political agendas in war. I think that young men die for strange political agendas. So I think that's one of the major things I learned. I also learned that if forces are going to be deployed, they need to understand and have a very clear picture of what the political strategic aim is. What is the government's aim? Because there's a lot of corruption in behind politicians in wars today, I think. The military are quite often deployed to support those agendas. And I think young men die for no cause a lot of the time.
That's an interesting conclusion you draw, somebody who has been very close to active combatant initiatives in a very tense environment. Just before I go on, did you ever happen to meet Ian Smith, who was clearly a central player in the Rhodesia situation?
No, not personally, no.
I only asked that. It won't mean a lot to most viewers. I was just interested because he seemed to play an ambiguous role at the time, but let's not go down that path. It's taking us too far away from what we're discussing. In the third part of the show, I want to talk with you about, of our discussion, I want to talk to you about lessons and applying those lessons to the current circumstances around the world. But sticking to where you are, how do you feel the final outcome in that particular part of Africa is playing out? Zimbabwe was initially led by a hugely popular leader who then became hugely unpopular, but it was the same person. It was Robert Mugabe. What's your feeling about the legacy that was left as a result of your formal investment in time and effort there?
Well, I mean, we'd look back. That's an interesting question, because halfway through the war, our war, I realized we couldn't win it. Because we hadn't embraced the local African people, we hadn't integrated with them. It's interesting because very few Rhodesians were taught the Shona language or the customs of the people and the traditions of the people. So we were isolated from them. And I think if they'd been brought together, there could have been a better outcome at the end of the day. But the outcome as it transpired was rather unfortunate because Robert Mugabe went the wrong way, destroyed the farming community and the economy, and ruled the country with corruption, really.
I had the impression that initially he was rather popular and that he'd actually done what might be regarded as an effective job, but only later he declined into a sort of despotic self-interest. Is that, I'm speaking from a distance there. You were much closer to it. What was your perception?
Well, I do mention that in the book because the head of the CIO, Central Intelligence Organization, is a man called Dan Stannard. He was one of my superior officers at the time. And unfortunately, what happened is that a lot of the farmers, after Mugabe took over power, a lot of the farmers supported what was an alternative political party called the MDC. And there was a video came out of a lot of finances being handed over to the MDC to fight against Mugabe. Now, up to that point, Mugabe had not touched the farmers and everything was fine. And he said to Dan Stannard, the head of the CIO, his head of CIO, he said, the farmers have turned against me. Now they will see me turn against them. And that's when it all started going wrong.
The odds pretty much implied an outcome. Yeah, it's hard to see how one can win anything other than a negotiated settlement with 24-1 against in terms of numbers. With the benefit of hindsight, and I think that the inference in the book is yes to the next question. With the benefit of hindsight, could it have been handled better?
Oh, yes. I mean, I mentioned in the book, I interviewed a lot of senior special branch officers. I interviewed Lord Owen. I met him. He actually gave me top secret documents and diaries. And I interviewed him. And I interviewed senior special branch officers who were involved in bringing together the nationalist leaders, particularly Joshua Nkomo and Ian Smith, for negotiations. Interestingly enough, special branch actually had informants right inside Joshua Nkomo's political setup. So we were being fed intelligence from Nkomo himself, and that was being fed directly to the government, to Ian Smith. But unfortunately, instead of using that to the benefit in order to get a settlement, they used it to keep them apart, keep them at bay.
And
so it should have been brought to an earlier settlement, and it could have been brought to an earlier settlement. In fact, as early as 1972, Ian Smith said to the head of CIO and the head of the special branch and some of the colleagues I interviewed, he said, we need to negotiate and get a settlement with the majority. And that was 1972. Now, the war only ended in 1980, so... yeah, I do believe there could have been a better settlement.
As I say, after the break, I want to talk about what you've learned and test your thinking about current conflicts. Let me just read a couple of comments. Sunshine Surfing says, great to listen to John Padbury on the radio TV. I've read his book. It's an incredible read, so you've got a fan there. And there is Lord Melbury says just received this, but oh, that's about something else. And there's a general feeling here that that we enter these wars often with no clear exit strategy. And in the next part of the show, John, I want to explore, well, three particular situations: what maybe should have happened in Afghanistan, people forget about it, what should be happening in terms of Britain and the Gaza situation, and then, of course, the ever-present issues in Ukraine. We'll come back to all of that. Do keep your calls and comments coming. And this is the Lembitopic Show right here on TNT. We're going to be talking with John Padbury about his decades of experience in terms of getting to a kind of peace. And I'm going to be asking him, is there a way of making the world safer without shooting the town up, the city up, the country up, based on what he knows about human nature and about negotiation? All of that with me, Lembitopic, on today's News Talk TNT. I'll see you after the break.
When a crisis hits, close to home and across the globe, nonprofits are on the front lines, ready to serve.
Keep going.
The demand for charitable services has skyrocketed, and nonprofits are rising to meet the needs. Healing. Nurturing. Rescuing. Honoring. Protecting. Caring. Inspiring. The work of philanthropic organizations of all sizes, across all missions, has never been more important. And it's donors and volunteers like you who make all this possible. Thank you. Together, we change the world. The Nonprofit Alliance.
You're with Lembitopic on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the Lembitopic Show here on today's News Talk TNT. I'm still with John Padbury. Coming up in the next hour, we'll be talking to the English Constitution Party, what they stand for and what mega means to them as well. But for now, we're still talking revolution, counter-revolution and mass mobilization. John Padbury, with your experience, you should be leading a revolution if you could find one. Does the idea appeal to you?
No, I don't think so. No, I think I've had my time. Yeah.
But you, in which case, I sort of feel similar about when people try to convince me and offer me safe seats in various parties in Britain. I feel I've done my time. I did 13 years in Parliament. That's quite enough. The job's not what it used to be. Maybe revolutions aren't either. But it does give you the qualification to comment on other situations around the world. Let's start with one which seems like ancient history now, but it's still going. Britain and America led the charge to try to conquer Afghanistan, which seemed to me a foolish ambition, considering no one's ever conquered Afghanistan, really. What should have happened, based on your experience, in terms of Afghanistan? Should America have invaded in the first place as a response to the 9/11 attack?
That's a big question. Well, history would tell us no, wouldn't it? Because they didn't succeed. If you're going into a scenario, one of the first strategies you have in your political strategic game is a successful withdrawal strategy when it's all over. And clearly that never happened. So I think they took on a. I think it was another unwinnable war.
In terms of the odds, again, there were orders of magnitude more either agnostics or insurgents than there were Western military personnel to enforce a victory there. I've often assumed it was simply a presidential re-election bid, which turned out to be successful, rather than any long-term strategic expectation or plan to subjugate Afghanistan. If you had been advising the British Prime Minister and the American President at the time, and leaving aside all the pragmatism that may have gone in the decision. And if they said to you, what should we do about Afghanistan, what would you have said?
If you're going to go into a host nation, I think the focus has to be on the people, the grievance needs and aspirations of the people. So if you're going to support a collapsed or failing government, you want to know why they've collapsed and why they're failing, because that inevitably is the fact that they're not attending to the needs of the people. In other words, the will of the people. A very similar conflict, just to diverge slightly, is what's going on in northern Mozambique at the moment, where you have a very heavy counter and a revolutionary insurgency going on. And that essentially is because the people have been abandoned there. The corporations have come in to extract the minerals, and the governments are corrupt, and the people themselves have been abandoned, and they're looking and saying, why are we not getting the benefit of the wealth of our own country? So I think if we're fighting a collapsed or failing government, you've already failed, because you haven't got the will of the people. It's the people who win these wars, not the superior forces. Same in Vietnam.
It seems to me that a lot of people think of Afghanistan as something roughly the size of Wales. Everything's always the size of Wales. Actually, Afghanistan's got a population of something like 40 million, which is more the size of Britain. And having a couple of 100,000 troops there simply isn't going to cut it when you think about the vast expanse of that territory and the fact that the West overtly used insurgency techniques through, perhaps, clearly ironically, through the likes of Osama bin Laden and the Mujahideen to do exactly what was then done to America and Britain a few years ago. Why do we not learn these lessons?
We don't learn them. I don't know why. History just keeps on going round and round and round. And Western response to revolution is always the same. They just don't learn.
And perhaps the same may be said of our involvement in Ukraine. The Pope himself has advised Zelensky to talk about terms of surrender. I'm not sure how many military initiatives the Pope's been involved in, but it probably didn't help Zelensky's case very much. What do you think's going on there? Is it possible for the West to bankroll Zelensky until Vladimir Putin in Moscow and his Politburo, or whatever he calls it now, go, oh yeah, we're beaten? Do you think that there's any prospect of that?
I think that's one of the most tragic recent wars for a long time. The deaths of the people is incredible. You know, Mao Zedong says that politics is war without bloodshed, and war is politics with bloodshed. So behind every conflict is that political issue. So the politicians start wars and the politicians end wars. Inevitably, it'll be a political settlement.
I was asked on a program what Estonia would do. Actually, it was on one of my colleagues' programs here on today's news talk, what Estonia might do or think about Russia. And the true answer was given by a man called Pats, who was the president of Estonia in the interwar years between 1939. He said, when big countries go to war, small countries bob like corks on a stormy sea. And it does seem to me that that is often the case. Yet Afghanistan is a comparatively large nation, as is Iran, which leads me to my next question. We've seen the stirring up of conflict with Israel killing upwards of 30,000 civilians in Gaza. We've seen Iran respond to what it considered to be unjustified and fatal aggression towards one of its embassy buildings, consulates in Syria. We seem to have taken the Israeli side here, and yet Iran has over 80 million people and the implicit support of a number of very influential countries. Based on what you've experienced in Africa and what you've observed in all of those very senior roles in what amounts to a kind of secret service, really, what do you think we should be doing about the Israeli situation and Britain's involvement in it?
The problem with politics is we just never know what's going on behind the scene. I think for better or for worse, the British are fully committed to it. I can't really comment on that, to be honest.
Okay, I don't want to put you in a position that you're not comfortable discussing. Looking ahead then, I know these are huge questions, but I don't often get the chance to ask somebody with your vast experience of being in the front line in what you yourself described as an unwinnable war, these questions. Looking ahead, and based on what you've experienced in looking back, are you an optimist about the future in terms of global peace and stability, or are you concerned that we're heading in a more dangerous direction? What do you feel?
I think we're definitely heading in a more dangerous direction. There's no question in my mind about that. If you think of the last year or so, everything's escalated quite astronomically. So I don't think, I'm not that optimistic for peace.
I suspect that when it comes to the Israeli-Gaza situation, it's hard to predict, as you say, what's going to happen, because the stakes are enormously high, and many believe that Benjamin Netanyahu needs to prolong the war to protect his own career. So all kinds of things going on there. And it's almost ironic to say that the Ukraine situation is simpler. Are we going to see a clear winner there, or is it likely to end up as a negotiated peace? In which case, hundreds of billions of dollars will have been wasted, including hundreds of thousands of lives.
Are you talking about Ukraine now?
Ukraine, yes. I'm talking about Ukraine.
Right. All wars will end politically. So there will eventually be a political solution. And that is the problem. What Smedley wrote about many years ago, war is a racket. So when you look at it and you think, the politicians started the wars, they fought away, lost hundreds of thousands of lives, and there will be a political settlement at the end of the day. So it will be a political settlement.
John Padbury, thank you for taking the time to speak with me and with the world, indeed, through today's News Talk TNT. You mentioned Clive Freeman earlier on, and on another occasion, you might talk about him. I really appreciate your time. And just remind us of the title of your book again.
It's Battle for Urungwe.
And that's authored by you, John Padbury. Thank you so much. That was John Padbury sharing his views. I welcome yours. I'll read some of them out after the break. Coming up next, we're coming to another case study in political activism. It's relevant to the whole world and happening in the United Kingdom. The English Constitution Party, what are they about? And what have dragons got to do with it? You'll learn all of that with me, Lembitopic, here on the Lembitopic Show on today's News Talk TNT. I'll see you in a few minutes.